ராம் கி ஸ்னவரி மை புராம் கி ஸ்ரீ ஜெகநாத் புரி ராம் கி கங்கமயி ஜமுனுமயி கி பக்தி தேவி துளசி தேவி கி ஸ்ரீ குரு பரம்பரா கி ஸ்ரீ சத்குஸ்வாமி பிரபு கி ஸ்வாமி கிரேசி பக்தி விராந்த சாமி ஸ்ரீல பிரபுபா கி ஸ்ரீமத் பகவத மகாபுராண கி ஸ்ரீமத் பக்தி விந்து கி கோர் பிரேமநந்தி ஹரி ஹரி போல் All glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. Glories to Srila Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
I'll start this one. So we left off at the bottom of page 8, point 18.3. It's a continuation of the Shloka Anusharanam. This is Sutta Goswami speaking. He says, though self-controlled dhira persons have nothing to fear from Kali, Maharaj Parikshit felt responsible for his less intelligent subjects. As a worthy representative of the high-born Kshatriya nature, the king, though powerful and ferocious as a tiger, was caring towards the careless and foolish. O sages, as you did ask me, now I have described almost everything regarding the narrations about Lord Krishna in connection with the history of the pious Maharaj Parikshit. The topics I relate here today ensure complete success in life for those who simply submissively hear them. The sages at Naimasharanya reply, O Sutta Goswami, because you speak very nicely about the activities of Lord Krishna, may you live for many years and have eternal fame. For mortal beings like us, your words are just like nectar. We have begun the performance of this sacrifice without certainty of its results due to the many imperfections in our actions. Although our bodies have become black from the smoke, we find ourselves doubtlessly pleased by the nectar of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Govinda that you distribute amongst us by your talks. So, those are the summaries of verses 8 through 10 in the first paragraph and 11 through 12 in the second paragraph. Nimesha 4a, we have a note from Srila Jiva Goswami in Bhakti Sandarbha Anuccheda 99. He's commenting on the statement that the sages have just made in verse 12. About their difficulties with the sacrifice. So point number 3, Jiva Goswami says, the words asmin karmani mean in this sacrifice, and anasvase means without certainty of result. The result is uncertain because of the presence of many unknown factors. The result is uncertain as, for example, in agriculture. And for those of you who have been reading this study guide side by side with the BBT edition of the first canto, you'll note that in Srila Prabhupada's purport, he makes exactly the same point about agriculture, that although one may, from the point of view of good farming, do everything properly, till the soil and throw the grain and water the earth and put up a scarecrow to keep away the crows and other birds that may come to pick at the sprouts as they come up. Still, there are unknown factors. A drought may be there, or it may be too rainy, or a powerful windstorm may come up and blow all the topsoil away, or so many factors may crop up that they're known as acts of God. So whether or not one is going to be able to harvest the results of one's work, that is never sure. So Srila Prabhupada makes the same point in his purport that Jiva Goswami makes here. But the sages continue that, however, it is said that the result of performing devotional service is certain. The phrase Duma, Dumaratmanam means our bodies and minds have become dirtied by the smoke. The word here is in the genitive case. It means of us. That is the meaning. So there's even indication here that this sacrificial performance is unable to cleanse the mind, because dumanatmanam refers not to just the body becoming blackened by the smoke, but the mind has its impurities. And even though one may be technically proficient in making all arrangements for yajna and chanting the mantras nicely, still the mind may not be purified. The mind may remain in some fruitive state, which is considered to be impure. And the sages are admitting this. So, Jiva Goswami goes on to say, devotional service, on the other hand, is completely dependable. So, point 4 of Anucheda 99, Jiva Goswami makes the point that here, pada padmasavam means the nectar of the lotus feet, and madhu means honey. The two activities being compared are A, the fruitive activity of this sacrifice, and B, devotional service, where there is hearing of the glories of the Lord. The sages here say, these non-devotional fruitive activities have made us unhappy. In this way, the superiority of devotional service is established. So, Jiva Goswami is taking this even one step further. Not only are these uncertainties and imperfections there, but the sages are actually saying, even though they're very experienced yogic Brahmins, and they do have all good intentions, as many of your students pointed out in essays you've written, actually by now it must have been months ago, when I raised that question about this part, that was quite a few months ago. I think it was, might have been even before the Gorpanima break, but I'm not certain.
One of the first essays.
Yeah, one of the first essays. I jumped. We wanted to see your opinion about the motivation of these sages, and so I jumped ahead to this very selection of verses here at the end of the ninth canto and asked you, what do you think about this? What do you think that it means? Does it mean that these sages are simply fruitive karmakanda workers who are merely interested in getting a good result? And therefore, Sutta Goswami's presence there reciting Srimad Bhagavatam was simply a part of their program to get good fruitive results. I believe that was the question I asked. So all of you responded, and that was a great relief to the negative. And also many of you pointed out that the sages did not merely have mundane intentions in mind for performing the sacrifice. Actually, their sacrifice was selfless in the sense that the results were meant for the benefit of all beings in Kali Yuga, because these sages could foresee that the age of Kali was coming upon the earth, and they wanted to do something according to their ability, to their training as yogic Brahmins. They wanted to do something for the benefit of all living entities. So there were two things involved. One was the sacrifice itself, and the other was the recitation of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the glories of the Lord, by an appropriately qualified devotee, Srila Sutta Goswami. So now, at this point, after so much has gone on, we're in the 18th chapter of the first canto, so that has meant by this time so much of the sacrifice has been performed, and simultaneously so many wonderful nectarian leelas and also spiritual instructions have been given by Sutta Goswami. So actually what's going on here is that the sages are summing up at this point their experience or opinion of the result of both. And so they're actually saying here, they're actually coming to the conclusion, as experienced yogic Brahmins, I mean, they're not beginners in this. They know exactly what they do to do. They know exactly how to set everything up. They know exactly what mantras to chant. All the rituals that are to be performed, that's second nature to them. But by their estimation, to this point, the next to the last chapter of Canto 1, is that these fruitive activities, these yogic activities, have actually simply made us unhappy. We are not satisfied by performing them. So then obviously one can extend that statement to the long-range purpose of this yajna, that this yajna's effect in deterring the influence of Kali in the world is pretty much useless. Pretty much we've been doing all this work, lighting these fires, offering these oblations, chanting these mantras, and we see the effect is useless. This is what they're actually admitting here. So that's point A, this fruitive activity of the sacrifice. And then point B, the devotional service where there's hearing of the glories of the Lord. These two points, when compared here, the sage's conclusion is these non-devotional activities have made us unhappy. Jiva Goswami concludes, in this way, the superiority of devotional service is established. And then in point five, Jiva Goswami goes on to cite a very interesting shloka from the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, 12:12:54, in which it is stated, the great endeavor. And the word for the great endeavor, now this is a great endeavor, let me just go on just to clarify. One undergoes in executing the ordinary social and religious duties of the Varnashram system. So it's great endeavor, but this is pious endeavor, but look at the word that has been chosen for great endeavor. The word is parishram. Now, can someone kindly give me a little light on this word parishram. Where might you have heard this before? You've got to know.
When people do a lot of endeavor for achieving mundane things.
Yeah, so what this parishram, David, what is it related to? Yeah, and it is a syllable within what word? Pavarga. You see, there's two words, pavarga and apavarga. So pavarga is a word that sums up material life, and it has been analyzed by Srila Prabhupada. Pa, the first syllable, is parishram, which means hard labor. And then pa comes next, pena, which means foaming sweat, like one will see on the sides of the body of a horse after a horse has been doing a lot of work, pulling a plow if a horse is used in that way, or in some way running hard, carrying a heavy load. A horse will sweat foam. So it is, in other words, this is very condemnatory language to use this word parishram, because it means to work like an animal, like a beast of burden. Pa, pa, and then what is the result? The result is bha. Bha means bhaya. Is that the right order? Ba. Yeah, so bha is bhaya. Ba, which means? Yes. So there's a word for disappointment. What is that word? Yes. Yes. One becomes disappointed, and then as one is realizing, as one gets older, having done all that work, and is actually seeing that the fruits of all that labor are not satisfying, as the sages state here, simply make us unhappy, then one goes from disappointment to bhaya, or fearfulness. It's a existential state of fear that, what have I lived my life for? You see, because time is marching on, I'm getting older, the energy of my body is being depleted, I have become habituated to doing things in this way. I have others who are dependents, and they expect me to do this, but I'm seeing that no happy result is coming out of it. I'm just working like on a, in the West they have this example, like on a treadmill. There's this exercising machine. You can run in place because it is a belt, technically called a conveyor belt, between two drums. So you can run on it, and the belt will move as you run. So you can run faster, as fast as you want, but you get nowhere. You see, you're just running. So one comes to the point of realizing that my whole life has been like that. I've just been running in place, and sweating, and going nowhere, and I don't have much strength left. I don't have much energy left. So what has all this meant? So one becomes fearful. And then finally, mrityu. Then finally death comes. And then one has to accept the karma that one has created by this type of more or less useless waste of one's life. That this word would be chosen in the shloka parishram is very, very meaningful. And And look at the context. The great endeavor one undergoes in executing the ordinary social and religious duties of the Varnashram system. This has been summed up as Parishram. In performing austerities and in hearing from the Vedas. See, all of this is being summed up as Parishram. Culminates only in the achievement of mundane fame and opulence, which means, what mundane means what? Temporary. Means, it's like a handful of sand. You see, a handful of nice golden sand. You can pick it up and it feels very nice, looks very nice, but what's happening? All the while it's dribbling away between your fingers and there's nothing left. In just a few moments, there's nothing left. I remember once we went down to myself and a couple of God brothers went all the way down to one of the Char Dham in the south, Rameshwaram. And we went to Dhanushkoti, which is where Lord Ramachandra broke the bridge that was built to Lanka. And we went there because that is one of the places that Lord Chaitanya visited in his tour of the south. And it was actually very... The actual place, Dhanushkoti, is very beautiful. There was a town there, but it had been leveled by some cyclone years before. So that wasn't so nice. There were a few people who were kind of, I guess they were fisher people or something like that, who were living between the ruins. But otherwise, it was a desolate place. But I remember just on the beach of that formed the tip of that Dhanushkoti, the sand was very golden and fine, and then that golden sand contrasted with the beautiful greenish blue of the sea. It was a very, very beautiful sight. And the sea was very gentle at the time, and it just went right to the horizon and everything. I think you could see one more island way off in the distance, so it was one of those typical, you know, when you get these tourist brochures of, you know, nice places to go vacation. It was a scene like that come to life. And I remember picking up a handful of that sand, and because the grains were very fine and soft and smooth, so it was a very, very nice feeling. But of course, what happens when you hold a handful of sand? It runs out between your fingers, So I remember that, and that is like the result of material activities. It just runs out between your fingers as soon as you take it. So all these things, social religious duties, austerities, and even hearing from the Vedas, it culminates only in the achievement of mundane fame and opulence. It will slip away between your fingers. But by respecting, the verse goes on to say, but by respecting and attentively hearing the recitation of the transcendental qualities of the Supreme Lord, the husband of the Goddess of Fortune, one can remember his lotus feet. So this means even at the time of death, that's why it is stressed. Jiva Goswami is stressing that. That even at the time of death, these other things will not help you. But if one, between the performance of all these other activities, which may be, according to one situation in a Varna Ashram, they may be necessary, they may be unavoidable, they may be one's duty in life. If one can hear about Krishna, then that will save one at the time of death. And then he quotes Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.22, certainly, therefore, since time immemorial, all transcendentalists have been rendering devotional service to Lord Krishna, the personality of Godhead, with great delight, because such devotional service is enlivening to the self. yenatma supasidati. You see? It is the soul, the actual self, that is the locustandi of desire. Desire is there because the soul, you see, this is one thing that we did a seminar here a while ago in the afternoon on Bhagavad psychology. So we explained how there's an equivalent in, there's one modern psychological discipline called depth psychology. And the image they give of the self or the mind, the consciousness, is that of an iceberg. They say just like an iceberg, as big as you might, the iceberg might look on the surface. And I once heard of an iceberg breaking off the Antarctic ice shelf that on the surface was as big as the country Belgium in Europe. But as big as that might be, that is only something like 7/8 of the entire mass of ice that's there. So, or 1/10. Somewhere 1/10, 7/8, like that. But anyway, it is a small fraction. The vast majority of the mass of the ice is under the water and invisible. That's why ships, when they come near such an iceberg, they have to make a wide berth around because they don't know what's underneath. The ice could be spreading out underneath the surface, and if the ship comes too near, can run up against the ice and break open and sink. So in the Western discipline of depth psychology, they envision the self to be like that. That our active consciousness is only one small portion of the total consciousness that is there, and the majority of the self is actually unknown to us. It is in the what they call the unconscious realm. So the Bhagavata agrees with that, actually, because the potential of the jiva, that is why it is said that the jivatma in this material life is sleeping. You see, and you look at the Purusha avatars, because the jiva is coming into this world by way of the Purusha avatars. You see, so first there is Mahavishnu. And how great Mahavishnu is, we cannot imagine. So there is even now a connection between ourselves here, sitting here in these bodies, and Lord Mahavishnu, because Brihadaranyaka Upanishad says that every night when we enter into dreamless sleep, susupti, we actually return to Mahavishnu, because these three Purusha avatars are non-different. Mahavishnu is non-different from Garbhodakashayi Vishnu, from whom Brahma appears and the whole universe is flowers out on the with the lotus that grows from Garbhodakashayi Vishnu's navel. That's the Virat Rupa. And then the localized Paramatma is expanding into the bodies of every living entity that Brahma creates. So the conscious part of the mind, which is manifest by the last of the Purusha avatars, Chirudakashayi Vishnu, or Lord Aniruddha, that is actually the smallest aspect of the self. Greater than that is that which is under the control of Garbhodakashayi Vishnu. When there is devastation, then the subtle bodies of the soul, our subtle bodies merge into Garbhodakashayi Vishnu. Therefore, he is known as Lord Narayan, the shelter of the Naras, that refers to the living entities and their subtle bodies. And then the causal bodies, the Karana Deha, they merge into the body of Mahavishnu. And according to the Upanishads, this is actually happening once within every 24 hours, not just at the time of Mahapralaya. So we have a connection with each one of these three Vishnus. So you can see proportionally how great Mahavishnu is. So great, we cannot imagine how great he is. Garbhodakarshayi Vishnu is filling the whole bottom of the universe. And then, of course, Supersoul is the size of a thumb within our heart. You see? So proportionately, that aspect of the self, the waking self, the Jagrata aspect of consciousness, is very small compared to the rest. So that is why it is clearly stated in Shastra that this soul is now asleep. More or less, we are asleep. And what we are experiencing now is a dream. You see? So this is material life. It is like a dream. So why are we having this dream? Because the self is not enlivened. The self, the actual spirit self, who is a spiritual personality, has nothing to do. Because there's no engagement in Krishna's service going. We're not taking that opportunity to serve Krishna. So therefore we're wasting our time having these useless dreams of mundane affairs. But when we can hear about Krishna, then yenatma supersiditi, then the self becomes satisfied and that self awakens. And there is a statement quoted in Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita purport that when one comes to self-realization, then one realizes these three Vishnus, these three Purusha avatars, and the soul's connection to every one of them. And then even beyond that, realizes Vaikuntha, and even beyond that, realizes Goloka Vrindavan. So this is the subject matter of the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So this whole awakening of the self in toto is accomplished by this very simple method of hearing about Krishna, the personality of God, with great delight. And that was also in that essay that we asked you to write, that was pointed out that the sages, they were not ordinary fruitive workers, because they were very eager to hear from Srila Sutta Goswami. It was their habit to be yogic Brahmins, that was their duty in life, but they had great eagerness. So therefore, they're actually classified, and this is the nectar of devotion, classified as, yes, neophyte devotees who are curious to hear about the Lord. I believe that's called jigyashu in the Bhagavad Gita. So when you read that part of Nectar of Devotion, the example of one who is in misery is Gajendra. So these are not, or also not just commonplace. They're said to be neophyte devotees, but these are not commonplace neophyte devotees, because they are mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam, every one of the cases. So similarly, the sages of Naimasharanya are given as the example of Jigyashu, devotees who are curious to hear about Krishna. That is why they're asking, generally through the mouth of Shaunaka Rishi, asking so many questions, because they're so curious about the subject matter. And we see here they're acknowledging that they're achieving great delight. And in comparison with their fruitive yajna, well, there's no comparison with the yajna performance they're doing. What they're saying is that this is the real nectar of our gathering here at the forest of Namasharanya, that we're having this chance to hear Srimad Bhagavatam. Please continue. I've taken more than half the time.
Is it your reading?
Namisha 4b is where we left off.
Okay. 4b. In his purport to 1.18.12, Srila Prabhupada concludes, the sages of Naimisharanya were practically sufferers from the smoke of a sacrificial fire and were doubtful about the result. But by hearing from a realized person like Suta Goswami, they were fully satisfied. In the Brahma Vaivarta Purana, Vishnu tells Shiva that in the age of Kali, men full of anxieties of various kinds can vainly labor in fruitive activity and philosophical speculations, but when they are engaged in devotional service, the result is sure and certain, and there is no loss of energy. In other words, nothing performed for spiritual realization or for material benefit can be successful without the devotional service of the Lord.
The point was made, I think it came up yesterday, that's why Maharaj Parikshit had no personal enmity towards the personality of Kali, because he understood this fact, that in the age of Kali, if one can manage to do just a little devotional service, one will get a very great result. And as far as impious activities, whereas in earlier ages there would be a reaction even for thinking about sinful deeds, in Kali Yuga there is no reaction. So it's a very contaminated age, and everyone knows who lives in this age, the mind is subject to so many low-grade thoughts. They're always passing through the mind. It's just the nature of things today. But fortunately, there's no reaction for that, which differentiates Kali from previous ages. So you actually have to perform the sinful activity before there will be a reaction. But pious activity or devotional service in particular, even if one thinks in one's mind, just like Prabhupada would give the example, if one goes, this is what he used to say, to encourage devotees to go on Harinam, that even if the people you see just walking by, if they hear the holy name, and if they just think, oh, this is nice, this is, oh, here's the Hare Krishnas again, if they just think in some positive way, then they achieve an inestimable good result from that. In other words, because the Lord is involved here, as explained, the Lord becomes, I think it was in a purport we read earlier, how one can actually arrest the Lord in the heart. The Lord is so inclined in this age to anyone who appreciates the Sankirtan movement or for just a moment chant Hare Krishna or say Hare Krishna to the devotees or accept a little prasad, that this arrests the presence of the Lord in the heart. Then from that moment on, the Lord becomes particularly attentive to that particular living entity and will guide him to further opportunities of devotional service.
It's also, that one, enlivening to the self, that part of the verse, because you're touching the energy, so no loss of energy, because the material Material nature means this loss of energy. You're putting in, but material energy is not returning anything. You know, it's just like pouring, like an example of ghee onto the ashes, or, you know, water on sand. It just disappears. But when devotional service means you're in touch with the spiritual energy. So not only is there not a loss, but there is a gain of energy because you're in touch with the spiritual, the internal potency. So then it's more enlivening. It picks up. So that's another aspect, that nothing's lost there. Otherwise, it's 1/10,000th the tip of the hair against 1/4 of the cosmic creation. Not good odds. I don't. You know, even the casinos are working under better odds than that, right? 18:3 continued. The sages proceed to voice in an important verse. Quote, the value of a moment's association with the devotee of the Lord cannot be compared even to the attainment of heavenly planets or liberation from matter. And so what to speak of worldly benedictions in the form of material prosperity, which are meant for those who are destined to die? Nimesha 5a, 13 purport. Srila Prabhupada summarizes the cause of the sage's good fortune at Naimisharanya. Devotional service is eternal. It has no end because it is spiritual. Therefore, since the assets of a pure devotee are completely different from material assets, there is no comparison between the two. Sutta Goswami was a pure devotee of the Lord, and therefore his association with the rishis in Naimisharanya is unique. In the material world, association with gross materialists is veritably condemned. The materialist is called yoshit sangi, or one who is very much attached to material entanglement, women and other paraphernalia. Such attachment is conditioned because it drives away the benedictions of life and prosperity. And just the opposite is bhagavat sangi, or one who is always in the association with the Lord's name, form, qualities, etc. Such association is always desirable. It is worshipable. It is praiseworthy, and one may accept it as the highest goal in life. Because the one you're putting in, as Maharaj was explaining in the previous point of Jiva Goswami, is you're putting in endeavor, but actually we're not actually getting anything back. Right? That's the thing, is that there's no satisfaction because happiness is simply attaining what the mind thinks it's going to make it happy. You think, if I get this car, I'm going to be happy because of the prestige of it, or its driving, or its facility, or comfort, or whatever it is, the inspiration for it. But it's only because the mind wants it, and you get it, that moment of getting it, you call that happiness. But the thing itself doesn't make you happy. You've decided speed or comfort or this is important. Therefore, it seems to be. But actually, it's not. It's only you're projecting onto it that this is going to make us happy. But it doesn't. Therefore, the sages are saying, you perform a material activity. You project onto it that this will make us happy. But it can't because it's dead matter. Right? And something that's not alive can't get you a goal. Mode of goodness is in the category of in the modes of prayojana. So only when the mind is in goodness, then it can be happy. But if it's in ignorance, which is the elements that it's made out of, means the field is the ignorance. So therefore it's absorbed in the things of the field. Therefore one cannot be satisfied. Just one can't be. Right, by nature, when the mind is in ignorance or absorbed in dead matter, it can't be satisfied. So only when it's absorbed in goodness, which is knowledge and uplifting, you know, then it's good. But even here, it's made a distinction between liberation. Even that's not good enough, because that's goodness. But there's still the ignorance of the Lord. So only when the proper hearing is done in connection with the Lord, then the mind can be satisfied. Otherwise, it can't be, no matter what's done. So that's the point the sages, as Maharaj is saying, great devotees, and they're performing these sacrifices, not that they want to go to the heavenly planets. They're thinking, we're yogic Brahmins. We should do something for the people of Kali Yuga. So we do yajna, so we'll do a yajna for their benefit. So the fruit is for someone else's benefit. So it's naishkarmya. But still, because it's dealing with the mundane materials, the result is not sure, because the element of daiva, right, the Lord, is there. So you may get, you may not. As you point out, the kanastafis are God, what do you call them? God sent, God, in the name of, calamities of nature, you said?
Acts of God.
Acts of God, right? So therefore, if your results are dependent upon the acts of God, so it may be good, may not be good, why not just depend upon God instead of your activity? Because if you depend upon Him, He's always blissful, He's always, so it's bound to rub off, right, by association. His devotees are happy, you associate with them, it will pick up. Right? So it's very important, see, all these we can see again and again, the same things being said, is we have to be convinced that material endeavor is not what's going to make us happy, right? Getting that little thing, or, you know, redoing the bathroom, or painting the wall, or getting the new cloth, or getting all these things, and you just arrange that, or just adjust your schedule, or just get a little more money, or just go to this place or that place. No, those are, the only value of them is their medium for devotional service. This yajna, the yajna itself is not what's important. But in a yajna, to have a bona fide yajna, there must be discussions of scripture. And in here, the great fortune is that scripture happens to be Srimad Bhagavatam. So now, the sage, because these sages, we have to remember, these same sages are the ones that have already heard Mahabharata and the 18 Puranas from the same Sutta Goswami. They've already heard. Right? So it's not that, yes, we're doing the yajna and hearing the scripture, it's so nice and so comforting. No. They're saying the yajna itself is not, it already contains karma and jnana. You're already hearing from scripture, you're already performing the yajna. It didn't work. Now we are hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. This is giving us satisfaction, right? But we see is that the medium, because of being neophyte, is coming through the medium of the yajna. The yajna regulates it, therefore there's discussion. No yajna, no discussion. Right? Does that make sense? So here, therefore, it's not the yajna becomes a good situation in which to hear about the Lord. Therefore, all the other activities of karma and jnana become useful in that they become causes of, in some way or another, hearing about the Lord and associating with the devotees. Does that make sense? So that's its use. So it's not, you can't throw it out because we're not Paramahamsas. When we're Paramahamsas, you don't have to worry about it. But since we do, then it's there. But one has to be convinced it's not the thing that's making us happy. It's actual, it's connection to the Lord. That's what's trying to be analyzed from many, many different angles, because this is where we're so stubborn. We just stubbornly, no, I'll do this and then I'll be happy, or I'll do that. No, it's none of that. If it's connected to Krishna, you're hearing about Krishna, you're associating with devotees, that's going to make you happy, and absolutely nothing else. Nimisha 5b. A doubt regarding the transcendence of Bhagavat Sangha is dealt with by Jiva Goswami in Anucheda 134 of Bhakti Sandarbha. The doubt is, if Bhagavat Sangha is transcendental, it must be nirgun. Yet the Lord seems to prefer to associate with the gunas embodied by the demigods. At the same time, he seems to disdain the gunas embodied by the asuras. Srila Jiva Goswami launches into his discussion by citing Bhagavatam 118.13. Now, this is why we want to, means just on the point of just the doubt that has arisen. Like, you can understand this is somebody who's really thought about it carefully, right? They know the Lord, they've heard about it, and they see he prefers the demigods and their modes, but not the demons and their modes. So the Lord's dealing with modes here, right? This is a very smart person that's brought this doubt up, right? This is why it's important to technically know the devotional process and the philosophy, so that one can clear those doubts. If you're very fixed, great, these doubts come up, who cares? But if you're not so fixed, better you know an answer. And if you're fixed and you're on your own, great, no problem. But if in any way you're associating with others that you could help who might be affected by these doubts, better you know the answer. Does that make some sense? So the idea of greatly, the great sophisticization of our life by bringing in so many fine technical details, but keep the philosophy as simple as it was in, you know, pre-nursery school, you know, that doesn't work. They have to match. Otherwise your intelligence is not engaged in the Lord's service. Body may be, mind may be, you know, being nice to everybody, but your intelligence is not. And unfortunately, there's a lot of very together, professional, intelligent people out there that may have doubts. Right? Now we move in our small circle. We don't see it. But we see here the acharyas, they moved on the cutting edge of society. Right? Jiva Goswami, who we're hearing from, he was gifted by Man Singh, who was the commander-in-chief of Akbar's army, who was the emperor of India, with the land, you know, encompassing the four main trees of Vrindavan. So that's Vrindavan proper. That was his. The title was in his hand. He was the deed holder, acknowledged by the emperor of India. This is where he's moving, right? Same Akbar, he has a doubt about whether the Ganga or Jamuna is superior. All the pundits, you'll have the best pundits in India. They can't answer. Who do they call upon? Rupa Goswami. Right? And they're willing to make the arrangement to bring Rupa from Vrindavan down to Delhi and back in the same day, and that's without the Agra, Delhi-Agra, you know, highway. You know, in one day, so he can come down and answer this question, sitting in Akbar's court with all on the peacock throne with all opulence, sitting there in his copins. Right? So this is cutting edge. Narottam Das Thakur, or was it Srinivasacharya, converted the king, who then decided that everybody in his kingdom had to be Vaishnavs, and he kicked out all the Mayavadis. Right? So we just see through the acharyas, Bhaktisiddhanta, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, all the intellectuals of India appreciated him. Right? That's the circles he was moving in. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, all the top, you know, people of Calcutta, Prabhupada, he could move with anybody, you know. Like that. So, therefore, that's Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Right? We're known for our books, not for our sentiment. The Sahajiyas are known for their sentiment. We're known for our books. Right? Ramanujas for their festivals. You know? Madhvas for their logic. You know? So we're known for our vast body of knowledge of the Gaudiya Vaishnav Siddhanta. Therefore, it's important to understand these things because these doubts will come up. As we become stronger, it polarizes. Right now, there's no polarization. You know, this thing, nobody says anything bad about the Hare Krishnas, but nobody even knows they exist. When Prabhupada was here, you had people that were completely for and completely against. Why? Because we were there. So there's polarization. So as it more and more we exist and the polarization is there, the greater and greater are going to be people that come up with these kind of fine-tooth comb, you know, problems. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, therefore, I'm just bringing that up because I feel sometimes it's thought, oh, what's the need of all this? No, it's very important because is we can answer any doubt if we ourselves are convinced. And this is the depth at which our own doubts go. You know? So in other words, you know, he's speaking to all of us here. That introduction to the point, then we end the class.
I think on Thursday we'll have to read Nimesha 5b again.
Yes.
Remind everyone of what the question was. Because what comes next is the answer.
Yes.
Okay.
Srila Prabhupada ki
jai.
Sarvadeva bhakti vrinda ki jai.
Hari Bol.